said Jack, but gently, gently. Let's see if we can draw them out. Drop the main topsail yard a couple of feet and slacken away the starboard lift. Let's look as though we were winged. Mr. Watt, the t'gallant backstays are our first care. And so they all moved back again across the same miles of sea, the Sophie knotting and splicing, the gunboats following and firing steadily, the old left-handed moon climbing with her usual indifference. There wasn't much conviction in the pursuit, but even so, a little while after James Dillon had reported the completion of the essential repairs, Jack said, "If we go about and set all sail like lightning, I believe we can cut those heavy chaps off from the land." "All hands about ship," said James. The boatswain started his call, and racing to his post by the main topsail bowline, Isaac said to John Lakey, "We're going to cut those two heavy buggers off from the land," with intense satisfaction. So they might have, if an unlucky shot had not struck the Sophie's fore-t'gallant yard. They saved the sail, but her speed dropped at once, and the gunboats pulled away ahead, away and away, until they were safe behind their mole. "Now, Mr. Ellis," said James, as the light of dawn showed just how much the sloop's rigging had suffered in the night, "here is a most capital opportunity for learning your profession. Why, I dare say there's enough to keep you busy until sunset, or even longer, with every variety of splice, knot, service, and parcelling you could desire." He was singularly gay, and from time to time, as he hurried about the deck, he hummed or chanted a sort of song. There was the swaying up of the new yard, too, some shot-holes to be repaired, and the bowsprit to be new-gammoned, for the strangest grazing ricochet had cut half the turns without ever touching the wood. Something the oldest seamen aboard had never yet beheld, a wonder to be recorded in the log. The Sophie lay there, unmolested, putting herself to rights all through that sunny, gentle day, as busy as a hive, watchful, prepared, bristling with pugnacity. It was a curious atmosphere aboard her. The men knew very well they were going in again very soon, perhaps for some raid on the coast, perhaps for some cutting-out expedition. Their mood was affected by many things. By their captures of yesterday and last Tuesday, the consensus was that each man was worth 14 guineas more than when he sailed. By their captain's continuing gravity, by the strong conviction aboard that he had private intelligence of Spanish sailings, and by the sudden strange merriment or even levity of their lieutenant. He had found Michael and Joseph Kelly, Matthew Johnson and John Meltham, busily pilfering aboard the Felipe Cinco between decks, a very serious court-martial offence, although custom winked at the taking of anything above hatches, and one that he particularly abhorred as being a damned privateer's trick. Yet he'd not reported them. They kept peering at him from behind masts, spars, boats, and so did their guilty messmates, for the Sophies were much given to rapine. The outcome of all these factors was an odd, busy, restrained, quietly cheerful attentiveness with a note of anxiety in it. With all hands so busy, Stephen scrupled to go forward to his elm-tree pump, through whose unshipped head he daily observed the wonders of the deep, and where his presence was now so usual that he might have been the pump itself for all the restraint he placed upon the men's conversation. But he caught this note, and he shared the uneasiness that produced it. James was in tearing spirits at dinner. He had invited Pullings and Babington informally, and their presence, together with Marshall's absence, gave the meal something of the air of a festivity, in spite of the purser's brooding silence. Stephen watched him as he joined in the chorus of Babington's song, thundering out, "And this is law I will maintain until my dying day, sir, that whatsoever king shall reign, I will be the vicar of Bray, sir," in a steady roar. "Well done," he cried, thumping the table. "Now, a glass of wine all round to whet our whistles, and then we must be on deck again. Though it's a cursed thing for a host to say. What a relief it is to be fighting with king's ships again, rather than these damned privateers," he observed, apropos of nothing, when the young men and the purser had withdrawn. "What a romantic creature you are, to be sure," said Stephen. "A ball fired from a privateer's cannon makes the same hole as a king's." "Me, romantic?" cried James with real indignation, an angry light coming into his green eyes. "Yes, my dear," said Stephen, taking snuff. "You'll be telling me next about their divine right."
"Well, at least even you, with your wild, enthusiastic, levelling notions, will not deny that the king is the sole fount of honour."
"Not I," said Stephen, "not for a moment." "When I was last at home," said James, filling Stephen's glass, "we waked old Terence Healy. He had been my grandfather's tenant, and there was a song they sang there has been in the middle part of my mind all day. I cannot quite bring it to the front to sing it."
"Was it an Irish song or an English?"
"There were English words as well. One line went, 'Oh, the wild geese a-flying, 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 the wild geese a-swimming upon the grey sea.'" Stephen whistled a bar, and then, in his disagreeable craic, he sang, "They will never return, for the white horse has scunnered. Has scunnered, has scunnered, the white horse has scunnered upon the green lea."
"That's it! That's it! Bless you!" cried James, and walked off, humming the air, to see that the Sophie was gathering the utmost of her strength. She made her way out to sea at sunset with a great show of farewell forever, and set her course soberly for Minorca. And some time before dawn she ran ashore again, still with the same good breeze a little east of north. But now there was a true autumnal nip in it, and a dampness that brought fungi in beech woods to Stephen's mind. And over the water lay impalpable, wafting hazes. Some of them a most uncommon brown. The Sophie was standing in with her starboard tacks aboard, steering west-northwest. Hammocks had been piped up and stowed in the nettings. The smell of coffee and frying bacon mingled together in the eddies that swirled on the weather side of her taut trysail. Wide on the port bow, the brown mist still hid the Llobregat valley and the mouth of the river. But farther up the coast towards the dim city looming there on the horizon, the rising sun had burnt off all but a few patches of haze. Those that remained might have been headlands, islands, sandbanks. I know... those gunboats were trying to lead us into some trap," said Jack, "and am with child to know what it was." Jack was no great hand at dissembling, and Stephen was instantly persuaded that he knew the nature of the trap perfectly well, or at least had a very good notion of what it was likely to be. The sun worked upon the surface of the water, doing wonderful things to its colour, raising new mists, dissolving others, sending exquisite patterns of shadow among the taut lines of the rigging and the pure curves of the sails, and down onto the white deck, now being scrubbed whiter to the steady, grinding noise of holystones. With a swift
yet imperceptible movement, it breathed away a blue-grey cape and revealed a large ship, 3 points on the starboard bow, running southwards under the land. The lookout called that she was there, but in a matter-of-fact voice, formally, for, as the cloud bank dissolved, she was hull up from the deck. "Very well," said Jack, clasping his glass too after a long stare. "What do you make of her, Mr. Dillon?"
"I rather think she is our old friend, sir," said James.
"So do I. Set the main staysail and haul up to close her. Swabs aft, dry the deck. And let the hands go to breakfast at once, Mr. Dillon. Should you care to take a cup of coffee with the doctor and me, it would be a sad shame to waste it."
"Very happy, sir."
There was almost no conversation during their breakfast. Jack said, "I suppose you'd like us to put on silk stockings, Doctor."
"Why silk stockings, for all love?"
"Oh, everyone says it's easier for the surgeon if he has to cut one up."
"Yes, yes, certainly. Pray do, by all means, put on silk stockings."
No conversation, but there was a remarkable feeling of easy companionship. And Jack, standing up to put on his uniform coat, said to James, "You're certainly right, you know." As though they'd been talking about the identity of the stranger throughout the meal. On deck again, he saw that it was so, of course. The vessel over there was the Cacafuego. She had altered course to meet the Sophie, and she was in the act of setting her studding sails. In his telescope he could see the vermilion gleam of her side in the sun. "All hands aft," he said. And as they waited for the crew to assemble, Stephen could see that a smile kept spreading on his face, that he had to make a conscious effort to repress it and look grave. "Men," he said, looking over them with pleasure, "that's the Cacafuego to windward, you know. Now, some of you were not quite pleased when we let her go without a compliment last time, but now, with our gunnery the best in the fleet, why, it's another thing. So, Mr. Dillon, we will clear for action, if you please." When he began to speak, perhaps half the Sophies were gazing at him with uncomplicated, pleasurable excitement. Perhaps a quarter looked a little troubled, and the rest had downcast and anxious faces. But the self-possessed happiness radiating for their captain and his lieutenant, and the spontaneous, delighted cheer from the first half of the crew changed this wonderfully. And as they set about clearing the sloop, there were not above 4 or 5 who looked glum. The others might have been going to the fair. The Cacafuego, square-rigged at present, was running down, turning in a steady westward sweep to get to windward and seaward of the Sophie. And the Sophie was pointing up close into the wind, so that by the time they were a long half-mile apart, she was directly open to a raking broadside from the frigate. The 32-gun frigate. "The pleasant thing about fighting with the Spaniards, Mr. Ellis," said Jack, smiling at his great round eyes and solemn face, "is not that they are shy, for they are not, but that they are never, never ready." The Cacafuego had now almost reached the station that her captain had set his mind upon. She fired a gun and broke out the Spanish colours. "The American flag, Mr. Babington," said Jack. "That'll give them something to think about. Note down the time, Mr. Richards." The distance was lessening very fast now, second after second, not minute after minute. The Sophie was pointing astern of the Cacafuego, as though she meant to cut her wake. And not a gun could the sloop bring to bear. There was a total silence aboard, as every man stood ready for the order to tack. An order that might not come before the broadside. "Stand by with the ensign," said Jack in a low voice, and louder. "Right, Mr. Dillon." "Helms a lee!" And the boatswain's call sounded almost at the same moment. The Sophie spun on her heel, ran up the English colours, steadied and filled on her new course, and ran, close-hauled, straight for the Spaniard's side. The Cacafuego fired at once, a crashing broadside that shot over and among the Sophie's topgallants, making four holes no more. The Sophies cheered to a man, and stood tense and eager by their treble-shotted guns. "Full elevation!"
"Not a shot till we touch!" cried Jack in a tremendous voice, watching the hen-coops, boxes and lumber tossing overboard from the frigate. Through the smoke he could see ducks swimming away from one coop, and a panic-stricken cat on a box. The smell of powder smoke reached them, and the dispersing mist closer. Closer. They would be becalmed under the Spaniard's lee at the last moment, but they would have way enough. He could see the round blackness of her guns' mouths now, and as he watched, so they erupted, the flashes brilliant in the smoke, and a great white bank of it hiding the frigate's side. Too high again, he observed. But there was no room for any particular emotion as he searched through the faults in the smoke to put the sloop right up against the frigate's main chains. "Hard over!" he shouted, and as the grinding crash came, fire! The Zeebeck frigate was low in the water, but the Sophie was lower still. With her yards locked in the Cacafuego's rigging, she lay there, and her guns were below the level of the frigate's ports. She fired straight up through the Cacafuego's deck, and her first broadside at a 6-inch range did shocking devastation. There was a momentary silence after the Sophie's cheer, and in that half-second's pause Jack could hear a confused screaming on the Spaniard's quarter-deck. Then the Spanish guns spoke again, irregular now but immensely loud, firing 3 feet above his head. The Sophie's broadside was firing in a splendid roll, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, with a half-beat at the end and a rumbling of the trucks. And in the fourth or fifth pause, James seized his arm and shouted, "They gave the order to board!" "Mr. Watt, boom her off!" cried Jack, directing his speaking trumpet forward. "Sergeant, stand by!" One of the Cacafuego's backstays had fallen aboard, fouling the carriage of a gun. He passed it round a stanchion, and as he looked up, a swarm of Spaniards appeared on the Cacafuego's side. The marines and small-arms men gave them a staggering volley, and they hesitated. The gap was widening, as the boatswain at the head and Dillon's party aft thrust on their spars. Amidst a crackling of pistols, some Spaniards tried to jump, some tried to throw grapnels. Some fell in and some fell back. The Sophie's guns, now 10 feet from the frigate's side, struck right into the midst of the waverers, tore 7 most dreadful holes. The Cacafuego's head had fallen off. She was pointing nearly south, and the Sophie had all the wind she needed to range alongside again. Again the thundering din roared and echoed round the sky, with the Spaniards trying to depress their guns, trying to fire down with muskets and blindly held chance pistols over the side to kill the gun crews. Their efforts were brave enough. One man balanced there to fire until he'd been hit 3 times, but they seemed totally disorganized. Twice again they tried to board, and each time the sloop sheered off, cutting them up with terrible slaughter, lying off 5 or 10 minutes, battering her upper works, before coming in again to tear out her bowels. By now the guns were so hot that they could scarcely be touched. They were kicking furiously with every round. The sponges hissed and charred as they went in, and the guns were growing almost as dangerous to their crews as to their enemies. And all this time the Spaniards fired on and on, irregularly, spasmodically, but never stopping. The Sophie's maintop had been hit again and again, and now it was coming to pieces. Great lumps of timber falling down on deck, stanchions, hammocks. Her foresail yard was held only by its chains. Rigging hung in every direction, and the sails had innumerable holes. Burning wad was flying aboard all the time, and the unengaged starboard crews were running to and fro with their fire buckets. Yet, within its confusion, the Sophie's deck showed a beautiful pattern of movement, the powder passing up from the magazine and the shot, the gun crews with their steady heave, crash, heave, a wounded man, a dead man, carrying below, his place instantly taken without a word, every man, intent, threading the dense smoke, no collisions, no jostling, almost no orders at all. "We shall be a mere hull presently, however," reflected Jack. It was unbelievable that no mast or yard had gone yet. But it couldn't last. Leaning down to Ellis, he said in his ear, "Cut along to the galley. Tell the cook to put all his dirty pans and coppers upside down. Pullings, Babington, stop the firing. Boom off, boom off. Back topsails, Mr. Dillon. Let the starboard watch black their faces in the galley as soon as I've spoken to them. Men! Men!" he shouted as the Cacafuego slowly forged ahead. "We must board and carry her. Now's the time. Now or never. Now or no quarter. Now while she's staggering. 5 minutes hearty and she's ours. Axes and broadswords and away. Starbolins black their faces in the galley and forward with Mr. Dillon. The rest aft along o' me." He darted below. Stephen had four quiet wounded men, two corpses. "We're boarding her," said Jack. "I must have your man. Every man, Jack, aboard. Will you come?"
"I will not," said Stephen. "I will steer if you choose."
"Do, yes, do. Come on," cried Jack. On the littered deck and in the smoke, Stephen saw the towering Zebex poop some 20 yards ahead on the port bow. The Sophie's crew in two parties, the one black-faced and armed, racing from the galley and gathering at the head, the other already aft lining the rail. The purser, pale and glaring, wild. The gunner blinking from the darkness below. The cook with his cleaver. Jack in the dust. The ship's barber and his own loblolly boy were there. Stephen noticed his hair lip grinning, and he cherishing the curved spike of a boarding axe, saying over and over again, "I'll hit the buggoth, I'll hit the buggoth, I'll hit the buggoth." Some of the Spanish guns were still firing out into the vacancy. "Braces!" called Jack, and the yards began to come round to fill the topsails. "Dear Doctor, you know what to do?" Stephen nodded, taking over the spokes and feeling the life of the wheel. The quartermaster stepped away, picked up a cutlass with a grim look of delight. "Doctor, what's the Spanish for 50 more men?"
"Otros 50."
"Otros 50," said Jack, looking into his face with a most affectionate smile. "Now, lay us alongside, I beg." He nodded to him again, walked to the bulwark with his coxswain close behind him, and hoisted himself up, massive but lithe, and stood there holding the foremost shroud and swinging his sword, a long, heavy cavalry sabre. Holes and all, the topsails filled, the Sophie ranged up. Stephen put the wheel hard over. The grinding crunch, the twang of some rope parting, a jerk, and they were fast together. With an enormous, shrieking cheer, fore and aft, the Sophies leapt up the frigate's side. Jack was over the shattered bulwark, straight down onto a hot gun running and smoking, and its swabber thrust at him with the pole. He cut sideways at the swabber's head. The swabber ducked fast, and Jack leapt over his bowed shoulder onto the Cacafuego's deck. "Come on! Come on!" he roared, and rushed forwards, striking furiously at the fleeing gun crew, and then at the pikes and swords opposing him. There were hundreds, hundreds of men crowding the deck, he noticed. And all the time he kept roaring, "Come on!" For some moments the Spaniards gave way as though amazed, and every one of the Sophie's men and boys came aboard, amidships and over the bow. The Spaniards gave way from abaft the mainmast, backing into the waist. But there they rallied. And now there was hard fighting. Now there were cruel blows given and received. A dense mass of struggling men tripping among the spars, scarcely room to fall, beating, hacking, pistoling one another, and detached fights of two or three men together round the edges, yelling like beasts. In the looser part of the main battle, Jack had forced his way some 3 yards in. He had a soldier in front of him, and as their swords clashed high, so a pikeman drove under his right arm, ripping the flesh outside his ribs and pulling out to stab again. Immediately behind him, Bondon fired his pistol, blowing off the lower part of Jack's ear and killing the pikeman where he stood. Jack fainted at the soldier. A quick double slash, and brought his sword down on his shoulder with terrible force. The fight surged back. The soldier fell. Jack heaved out his sword, tight in bone, and glanced quickly fore and aft. "This won't do," he said. Forward, under the forecastle, the sheer weight and number of the 300 Spaniards, now half recovered from their surprise, was pushing the Sophie's back, driving a solid wedge between his band and Dillon's in the bows. Dillon must have been held up. The tide might turn at any second now. He leapt onto a gun, and with a hail that ripped his throat, he roared, "Dillon! Dillon! The starboard gangway! Thrust for the starboard gangway!" For a fleeting moment, at the edge of his field of vision, he was aware of Stephen, far below on the deck of the Sophie, holding her wheel and gazing collectedly upwards. "Otra cincuenta!" he shouted for good measure, and as Stephen nodded, calling out something in Spanish, he raced back into the fight, his sword high and his pistol searching. At this moment, there was a frightful shrieking on the forecastle, a most bitter, furious drive for the head of the gangway, a desperate struggle. Something gave, and the dense mass of Spaniards in the waist turned to see these black faces rushing at them from behind. A confused milling round the frigate's bell, cries of every kind, the blackened Sophies cheering like madmen as they joined their friends, shots, the clash of arms, a trampling, huddled retreat, all the Spaniards in the waist, hampered, crowded in upon, unable to strike. The few on the quarterdeck ran forward along the larboard side to try to rally the people, to bring them into some order, at least to disengage the useless marines. Jack's opponent, a little seaman, writhed away behind the capstan, and Jack heaved back out of the press. He looked up and down the clear run of deck. "Bondon!" he shouted, plucking his arm. "Go and strike those colours!" Bondon ran aft, leaping over the dead Spanish captain. Jack hallooed and pointed. Hundreds of eyes, glancing, or staring, or suddenly looking back, half-comprehending, saw the Cacafuego's ensign race down. Her colours struck. It was over. "Last fighting!" cried Jack, and the order ran round the deck. The Sophies backed away from the packed mob in the waist, and the men there threw down their weapons, suddenly dispirited, frightened, cold, and betrayed. The senior surviving Spanish officer struggled out of the crowd in which he had been penned and offered Jack his sword. "Do you speak English, sir?" asked Jack.
"I understand it, sir," said the officer.
"The men must go down into the hold, sir, at once," said Jack. "The officers on deck. The men down into the hold. Down into the hold." The Spaniard gave the order. The frigate's crew began to file down the hatchways. As they went, so the dead and wounded were discovered. A tangled mass amidships, many more foreheads, single bodies everywhere. And so, too, the true number of the attackers grew clear. "Quickly, quickly," cried Jack, and his men urged the prisoners below, herding them fast, for they understood the danger as well as their captain. "Mr. Day, Mr. Watt, get a couple of their guns, those carronades, pointing down the hatchways, load with canister. There's plenty in the garlands aft. Where's Mr. Dillon? Pass the word for Mr. Dillon." The word passed, and no answer came. He was lying there near the starboard gangway, where the most desperate fighting had been, a couple of steps from little Ellis. When Jack picked him up, he thought he was only hurt. But turning him, he saw the great wound in his heart. Chapter 11. Her Majesty's sloop Sophie, off Barcelona. Sir, I have the honour to acquaint you that the sloop I have the honour to command, after a mutual chase and a warm action, has captured a Spanish Zeebeck frigate of 32 guns, 22 long 12-pounders, 8 nines and 2 heavy carronades, viz. The Cacafuego, commanded by Don Martin de Langara, manned by 319 officers, seamen and marines. The disparity of force rendered it necessary to adopt some measure that might prove decisive. I resolved to board, which, being accomplished almost without loss, after a violent, close engagement, the Spanish colours were obliged to be struck. I have, however, to lament the loss of Lieutenant Dillon, who fell at the height of the action leading his boarding party, and of Mr. Ellis, a supernumerary, while Mr. Watt, the boatswain, and 5 seamen were severely wounded. To render just praise to the gallant conduct and impetuous attack of Mr. Dillon, I am perfectly unequal to. I saw him for a while, Stephen had said. I saw him through that gap where 2 ports were beaten into 1. They were fighting by the gun, and then, when you called out at the head of those stairs into the waist, and he was in front, black faces behind him, I saw him pistol a man with a pike, pass his sword through a fellow who had beaten down the boatswain, and come to a redcoat, an officer. After a couple of quick passes, he caught this man's sword on his pistol and lunged straight into him. But his sword struck on the breastbone or a metal plate and doubled and broke with the thrust. And with the 6 inches left, he stabbed him faster than you could see. Inconceivable force and rapidity. You would never believe the happiness on his face, the light on his face. I must be permitted to say that there could not have been greater regularity nor more cool, determined conduct shown by men than by the crew of the Sophie. The great exertions and good conduct of Mr. Pullings, a past midshipman and acting lieutenant, whom I beg to recommend to their lordship's attention, and of the boatswain, carpenter, gunner, and petty officers, I am particularly indebted for. I have the honour to be, etc. Sophie's force at commencement of action, 54 officers, men and boys, 14 four-pounders, 3 killed and 8 wounded. Cacafuego's force at commencement of action, 274 officers, seamen and supernumeraries, 45 marines, guns, 32. The captain, boatswain, and 13 men killed, 41 wounded. He read it through, changed "I have the honour" on the first page to "I have the pleasure," signed it John Aubrey, and addressed it to M. Hart, Esquire. Not to Lord Keith, alas, for the Admiral was at the other end of the Mediterranean, and everything passed through the hands of the Commandant. It was a passable letter. Not very good for all his efforts and revisions. He was no hand with a pen. Still, it gave the facts, some of them,
and apart from being dated off Barcelona in the customary way, whereas it was really being written in Port Mahon the day after his arrival, it contained no falsehood. And he thought he'd done everyone justice. Had done all the justice he could, at least, for Stephen Maturin had insisted upon being left out. But even if it had been a model of naval eloquence, it would still have been utterly inadequate, as every sea officer reading it would know. For example, it spoke of the engagement as something isolated in time, coolly observed, reasonably fought, and clearly remembered, whereas almost everything of real importance was before or after the blaze of fighting. And even in that, he could scarcely tell what came first. As to the period after the victory, he was unable to recapture the sequence at all without the log. It was all a dull blur of incessant labour and extreme anxiety and weariness. 300 angry men to be held down by 24, who also had to bring the 600-ton prize to Minorca through an ugly sea and some cursed winds. Almost all the sloops standing and running rigging to be set up anew, masts to be fished, yards shifted, fresh sails bent, and the boatswain among the badly wounded. That hobbling voyage along the edge of disaster, with precious little help from the sea or the sky. A blur and a sense of oppression, a feeling more of the Cacafuego's defeat than the Sophie's victory, and exhausted perpetual hurrying, as though that were what life really consisted of. A fog, punctuated by a few brilliantly clear scenes. Pullings, there on the bloody deck of the Cacafuego, shouting in his deafened ear that gunboats were coming down from Barcelona. His determination to fire the frigate's undamaged broadside at them. His incredulous relief when he saw them turn at last and dwindle against the threatening horizon. Why? The sound that woke him in the middle watch. A low cry, mounting by quarter tones or less, and increasing in volume to a howling shriek. Then a quick series of spoken or chanted words, the mounting cry again, and the shriek. The Irishman of the crew, waking James Dillon, stretched there with a cross in his hands and lanterns at his head and feet. The burials. That child Ellis, in his hammock, with the flag sewed over him, looked like a little pudding. And now at the recollection his eye clouded again. He had wept, his face streaming with tears as the bodies went over the side and the marines fired their volley. Dear Lord, he thought. Dear Lord. For the rewriting of the letter and this casting back of his mind brought all the sadness flooding up again. It was a sadness that had lasted from the end of the action until the breeze had died on them some miles off Cape Mola, and they had fired urgent guns for a pilot and assistance. A sadness that fought a losing battle against invading joy, however. Trying to fix the moment when the joy broke through, he looked up, stroking his wounded ear with the feather of his pen, and through the cabin window he saw the tall proof of his victory at her moorings by the yard. Her undamaged larboard side was towards the Sophie, and the pale water of the autumn day reflected the red and shining gold of her paintwork, as proud and trim as the first day he'd seen her. Perhaps it was when he received the first, unbelieving, amazed congratulations from Sennett of the Bellerophon, whose gig was the first boat to reach him. Then there was Butler of the Naiad, and young Harvey, Tom Widrington, and some midshipmen, together with Marshall and Mowat, almost out of their minds with grief at not having taken part in the action, yet already shining with reflected glory. Their boats took the Sophie and her prize in tow. Their men relieved the exhausted marines and idlers guarding the prisoners. He felt the accumulated weight of those days and nights come down on him in a soft, compelling cloud, and he went to sleep in the midst of their questions. That marvellous sleep, and his waking in the still harbour, to be given a quick, unsigned note in a double cover from Molly Hart. Perhaps it was then, the joy, the great swelling delight was certainly in him when he woke. He grieved, of course he grieved. He grieved bitterly for the loss of his shipmates, but had given his right hand to save them. And mixed in his sorrow for Dylan there was a guilt whose cause and nature eluded him. But a serving officer in an active war has an intense rather than a lasting grief. Sober, objective reason told him that there had not been many successful single-ship actions between quite such unequal opponents, and that unless he did something spectacularly foolish, unless he blew himself as high as the Boyne, the next thing that would reach him from the Admiralty would be the news of his being gazetted, of his being made a post-captain. With any kind of luck, he'd be given a frigate. And his mind ran over those glorious high-bred ships. Emerald, Seahorse, Terpsichore, Phaeton, Sibyl, Sirius, the lucky Athalian, Naiad, Alcmaeon and Triton, the flying Thetis, Endymion, San Fiorenzo, Amelia, dozens of them, more than 100 in commission. Had he any right to a frigate? Not much. A 20-gun post ship was more his mark, something just in the sixth rate. Not much right to a frigate. Not much right to set about the Cacafuego, either. Nor to make love to Molly Hart. Yet he had done so. In the postchaise, in a bower, in another bower, all night long. Perhaps that was why he was so sleepy now, so apt to doze, blinking comfortably into the future as though it were a sea-coal fire. And perhaps that was why his wounds hurt so. The slash on his left shoulder had opened at the far end. How he'd come by it, he couldn't tell. But there it was, after the action, and Stephen had sewn it up at the same time he dressed the pike wound across the front of his chest. One bandage for the two, and clapped a sort of dressing on what was left of his ear. But dozing would not do. This was the time for riding in with the tide of flood, for making a dash for a frigate, for seizing fortune while she was in reach, running her aboard. He would write to Queenie at once, and half a dozen letters more that afternoon before the party, perhaps to his father too. Or would the old boy make a cock of it again? He was the worst hand imaginable at plot, intrigue, or the management of what tiny amount of interest they had with the grander members of the family. Should never have reached the rank of general by rights. However, the public letter was the first of these things, and Jack got up carefully, smiling still. This was the first time he'd been openly ashore, and early though it was, he couldn't but be conscious of the looks, the murmurs and the pointing that accompanied his passage. He carried his letter into the commandant's office, and the compunction, the stirrings, if not of conscience or principle, then at least of decency, that had disturbed him on his way up through the town, and even more in the anteroom, disappeared with Captain Hart's first words. "Well, Aubrey," he said without getting up, "we are to congratulate you upon your prodigious good luck again, I collect." "You're too kind, sir," said Jack. "I've brought you my official letter." "Oh, yes. said Captain Hart, holding it some way off and looking at it with an affectation of carelessness. "I'll forward it presently. Mr. Brown tells me it's perfectly impossible for the Yard here to supply half your wants. He seems quite astonished that you should want so much. How the devil did you contrive to get so many spars knocked away, and such a preposterous amount of rigging? Your sweep's destroyed. There are no sweeps here. Are you sure your bosun isn't coming in a trifle high? Mr. Brown says there's not a frigate on the station, nor even a ship of the line that has called for half so much cordage."
"If Mr. Brown can tell me how to take a 32-gun frigate without having a few spars knocked away, I shall be obliged to him."
"Oh, well, in these sudden surprise attacks, you know. However, all I can say is you'll have to go to Malta for most of your requirements. Northumberland and Superb have made a clean sweep here." It was so evidently his intention to be ill-natured that his words had little effect. But his next stroke slipped under Jack's guard and stabbed right home. "Have you written to Ellis's people yet?" This sort of thing, tapping the public letter, is easy enough. Anyone can do this. But I don't envy you the other. What I shall say myself, I don't know. Biting the joint of his thumb, he darted a furious look from under his eyebrows. And Jack had a moral certainty that the financial setback, misfortune, disaster, or whatever it was, affected him far more than the debauching of his wife. Jack had, in fact, written that letter, as well as the others, Dylan's uncle, the seamen's families, and he was thinking of them as he walked across the patio with a sombre look on his face. A figure under the dark gateway stopped, obviously peering at him. All Jack could see in the tunnel through to the street was an outline and the two epaulettes of a senior post-captain or a flag officer. So, although he was ready with his salute, his mind was still blank when the other stepped through into the sunlight, hurrying forward with his hand outstretched. "Captain Aubrey, I do believe. Keats of the Superb. My dear sir, you must allow me to congratulate you with all my heart. A most splendid victory indeed. I've just pulled round your capture in my barge, and I'm amazed, sir. Amazed! Was you very much clawed? May I be of any service, my bosun, carpenter, sailmakers? Would you do me the pleasure of dining aboard, or are you bespoke? I dare say you are. Every woman in Mahon will wish to exhibit you. Such a victory!" "Why, sir, I thank you most heartily," cried Jack, flushing with undisguised, open, ingenuous pleasure, and returning the pressure of Captain Keats' hand with such vehemence as to cause a dull crepitation followed by a shattering dart of agony. "I'm infinitely obliged to you, sir, for your kind opinion. There is none I value more, sir. To tell you the truth, I'm engaged to dine with the governor and to stay for the concert. But if I might beg the loan of your bosun and a small party, my people are almost uncommon weary, quite fagged out. Why, I should look upon it as a most welcome, indeed a heaven-sent relief." "It shall be done. Most happy," said Captain Keats. "Which way do you go, sir, up or down?"
"Down, sir. I've appointed to meet a person at the Crown."
"Then our ways lie together," said Captain Keats, taking Jack's arm. And as they crossed the street to walk in the shade, he called out to a friend, "Tom, come and see who I have in tow. This is Captain Aubrey of the Sophie. You know Captain Grenville, I'm sure."
"This gives me very great pleasure," said the grim, battle-scarred Grenville, breaking out into a one-eyed smile. He shook Jack by the hand and instantly asked him to dinner. Jack had refused 5 more invitations by the time he and Keats parted at the Crown. From mouths he respected, he had heard the words, "As neat an action as ever I knew, Nelson will rejoice in this," and "If there is justice on earth, the frigate will be bought by government, and Captain Aubrey given command of her."
He had seen looks of unfeigned respect, goodwill and admiration upon the faces of seamen and junior officers passing in the crowded street, and two commanders, senior to him, unlucky in prizes and known to be jealous, had hurried across to make their compliments, handsomely and with good grace. He walked in, up the stairs to his room, threw off his coat and sat down. "This must be what they call the vapours," he said, trying to define something happy, tremulous, poignant, church-like, and not far from tears in his heart and bosom. He sat there. The feeling lasted, indeed grew stronger. And when Mercedes darted in, he gazed at her with a mild benevolence, a kind and brotherly look. She darted in, squeezed him passionately, and uttered a flood of Catalan into his ear, ending, "Brave, brave, Captain, good, pretty and brave." "Thank you. Thank you, Mercy, dear. I'm infinitely obliged to you. Tell me," he said, after a decent pause, trying to shift to an easier position. A plump girl, a good 10 stone. "Digame, would you be a good creature, bona creatura, and fetch me some iced negus? Sangria colda? Thirst, soif, very thirst, I do assure you, my dear." "Your auntie was quite right," he said, putting down the beaded jug and wiping his mouth. "The Vinaro ship was there to the minute, and we found the false Ragusan. So here, aquí, aquí, is auntie's reward. The recompensa de tua tia, my dear." Pulling a leather purse out of his breeches pocket. "Y aquí," bringing out a neat sealing-waxed packet, "is a little regalo para vous, sweetheart." "Present?" cried Mercedes, taking it with a sparkling eye, nimbly undoing the silk, tissue paper, jeweller's cotton, and finding a pretty little diamond cross with a chain. She shrieked, kissed him, darted to the looking-glass, shrieked some more, "Eek! Eek!" and came back with the stone flashing low on her neck. She pulled herself in below and puffed herself out above like a pouter pigeon, and lowered her bosom, the diamonds winking in the hollow down towards him, saying, "You like him? You like him? You like him?" Jack's eyes grew less brotherly. Oh, far less brotherly. His glottis stiffened, and his heart began to thump. "Oh, yes, I like him," he said hoarsely.
"Timely, sir, boatswain of the Superb,"
said a tremendous voice at the opening door.
"Oh, beg pardon, sir."
"Not at all, Mr. Timely," said Jack. "I'm very happy to see you." And indeed, perhaps it was just as well, he reflected, landing again at the rope-walk stairs, leaving behind him a numerous body of skilful, busy superbs rattling down the newly set up shrouds, there being so much to do. But what a sweet girl it is. He was now on his way to the governor's dinner. That, at least, was his intention. But a bemused state of mind, swimming back into the past and onwards into the future, together with a reluctance to seem to parade himself in what the sailors called the High Street, brought him by obscure backways filled with the smell of new fermenting wine and purple guttered with the lees, to the Franciscan church at the top of the hill. Here, summoning his wits into the present, he took new bearings. And looking with some anxiety at his watch, he paced rapidly along by the armoury, past the green door of Mr. Flory's house, with a quick upward glance, and headed northwest by north for the residence. Behind the green door, and some floors up, Stephen and Mr. Flory were already sat down to a haphazard meal, spread wherever there was room on odd tables and chairs. Ever since coming back from the hospital, they had been dissecting a well-preserved dolphin, which lay on a high bench by the window next to something covered by a sheet. "Some captains think it the best policy to include every case of bloodshed or temporary incapacity,"
said Mr. Flory, "because a long butcher's bill looks well in the Gazette. Others will admit no man that is not virtually dead, because a small number of casualties means a careful commander. I think your list is near the happy mean, though perhaps a trifle cautious. You're looking at it from the point of view of your friend's advancement, of course."
"And just so."
"Yes. Allow me to give you a slice of this cold beef. Pray reach me a sharp knife. Beef, above all, must be cut thin if it is to savour well."
"There's no edge on this one," said Stephen. "Try the catling."
He turned to the dolphin.
"No," he said, peering under a flipper. "Where can we have left it?
Ah," lifting the sheet, "here's another. Such a blade. Swedish steel, no doubt. You began your incision at the Hippocratic point, I see," he said, raising the sheet a little more and gazing at the young lady beneath it.
"Perhaps we ought to wash it," said Mr. Flory.
"Oh, a wipe will do that," said Stephen, using a corner of the sheet. "By the way, what was the cause of death?" he asked, letting the cloth fall back. "That's a nice point," said Mr. Flory, carving a first slice and carrying it to the griffon vulture tied by the leg in a corner of the room. "That's a nice point, but I'm rather inclined to believe that the battering did her business before the water. These amiable weaknesses, follies." "Yes, your friend's advancement." Mr. Flory paused, gazing at the long, straight, double-edged catling and waving it solemnly over the joint. "If you provide a man with horns, he may gore you," he observed with a detached air, covertly watching to see what effect his remark might have.
"Very true,"
said Stephen, tossing the vulture a piece of gristle. "In general, feinem habentin cornu, but surely," he said, smiling at Mr. Flory, "you're not throwing out a generality about cuckolds. Do not you choose to be more specific?
Or do you perhaps refer to the young person and the sheet? I know you speak from your excellent heart, and I assure you no degree of frankness can possibly offend."
"Well," said Mr. Flory, "the point is that your young friend, our young friend, I may say, for I have a real regard for him, and look upon this action as reflecting great credit upon the service, upon us all, our young friend has been very indiscreet. So as the lady. You follow me, I believe?"
"Oh, certainly."
"The husband resents it, and he is in such a position that he may be able to indulge his resentment unless our friend is very careful. Most uncommon cautious. The husband will not ask for a meeting, for that is not his style at all. A pitiful fellow. But he may try to entrap him into some act of disobedience and so bring him to a court-martial. Our friend is famous for his dash, his enterprise, and his good luck, rather than for his strict sense of subordination. And some few of the senior captains here feel a good deal of jealousy and uneasiness at his success. What is more, he's a Tory, or his family is. And the husband and the present First Lord are rabid Whigs. Vile, ranting dogs of Whigs. Do you follow me, Dr. Maturin?"
"I do indeed, sir.
And I'm much obliged to you for your candour in telling me this. It confirms what was in my mind, and I shall do all I can to make him conscious of the delicacy of his position. Though, upon my word," he added with a sigh, "there are times when it seems to me that nothing short of a radical ablation of the membrum virile would answer in this case. That is, very generally, the peccant part," said Mr. Flory. Clerk David Richards was also having his dinner, but he was eating it in the bosom of his family. "As everyone knows," he told the respectful throng, "the captain's clerk's position is the most dangerous there is in a man of war. He's up there all the time on the quarter-deck with his slate and his watch to take remarks next to the captain, and all the small arms and a good many of the great guns concentrate their fire upon him. Still,
There he must stay, supporting the captain with his countenance and his advice.
"Oh, Davy," cried his aunt,
"and did he ask your advice?"
"Did he ask my advice, ma'am?"
"Upon my sacred word, don't swear, Davy, dear," said his aunt automatically. "It ain't genteel."
"La, Mr. Richards," says he, when the main top begins to tumble about our ears, tearing down through the quarter-deck splinter netting like so much Berlin wool, "I don't know what to do. I'm quite at a loss, I protest." "There's only one thing for it, sir," says I. "Board 'em, board 'em, fore and aft, and I give you my sacred word the frigate's ours in 5 minutes." "Well, ma'am and cousins, I don't like to boast, and I confess it took us 10 minutes. But it was